to speak to you about my experience of what I can only begin to describe as a melancholic gaze. And for those of you who may not have seen Lars von Trier's extraordinary film of 2011 entitled Melancholia, it seems important to begin by saying that it's a film about the end of the world. In fact, to be more specific, it's a film about the approach of the end of the world as a result of the Earth crashing into an enormous planet called Melancholia. The symbolism here is hardly subtle. And these screenshots that I just want to show you from the ending of the film give a flavour of the experience. So there's a apposite quotation here from Lars von Trier, and I will return to the interview from which this quotation is taken at the end. Von Trier has suggested that your therapist would say a depression is not the end of the world, but yes, it is. Okay, and this is his iteration of this. So this is full of spoilers, but this is the end of this film, and these are screenshots from the very final sequence. And you can see the onset of the end of the world, the kind of engulfing of our main protagonists, surviving protagonists, in flames, which become ever closer, threatening us as members of the audience, and then the screen cuts to black, a trick that von Trier is very fond of. So my own experience of this film was one of very profound bleakness, and I found myself, despite being absolutely unable to put the images of the film and the cinematography in particular to one side in terms of my psychological experience, unable to say a word about it. And this persisted not just for months, but also for many years. And I felt in the end as though something unspeakable had taken place inside me. And yet at the same time, I felt overwhelmed by a plenitudinous sense of the film's astonishing beauty. It seemed to be awe-inspiring and terrible all at once. And yet I hesitate to name this experience as something akin to the sublime. Its texture, for me, was profoundly psychological. And this has prompted my musings today on how we might make sense of the film. By now, after 20 years in my career, it comes as second nature for me to try to think through the lens of psychoanalytic ideas. And yet in preparing for this talk, I felt really stuck, constantly questioning my thought processes and my capacity to work with complex psychoanalytic ideas that actually I think I ought to know quite well. In short, then, I fear that when it comes to this film, I'm caught up in a mode of what we might understand as melancholic thinking. And I've only properly started to understand this recently. So what I want to do here is to try to mobilise a few starting points of thinking and discussion by inviting you to take an excursion with me through some aspects of psychoanalysis that have helped me actually to get here today to this lectern, trying to say what I think I might want to say about my experience of this film, and the challenges and invitations extended to us through it by Lars von Trier. To begin with, there is Klein, someone about whom we've heard a little today, but I want to kind of jump off a little bit in the direction of object relations theory, if you will indulge me. The filmic narrative of Melancholia almost, I think, demands a Kleinian reading, with its very striking themes of splitting, annihilation, persecutory anxiety, paranoia, and of course, the bad parental objects. And it's very well documented that Klein differs slightly, but also in very important ways from Freud in her conceptualization of melancholia, in that for Klein, all losses revive earlier experiences of loss, and so require what she calls the reworking of the internal world in order for recovery to take place. For Melanie Klein, the infantile depressive position is what she calls a melancholia in statu nascendi. All losses, both real and fantasied, are rooted in the experience of early infantile losses of what she describes as the mother's breast and all that the breast and milk have come to stand for in the infant's mind, namely love, goodness, and security. She says all of these are felt by the baby to be lost, and lost as a result of his own uncontrollable, greedy, and destructive impulses. So the unconscious fantasy underpinning the experience lost, then, is that of having lost his internal good objects as well. He then feels that his internal bad objects predominate, and his inner world is in danger of disruption. So splitting for Klein is key, and she alerts us to this dimension of the melancholic experience, suggesting that there's a reversion to an early infantile paranoid schizoid mechanism that leads to idealization and denigration, and this characterizes the melancholic disposition. And I think this can also be said to underpin the ambivalence that Freud identifies as key to the more manic formations of melancholic identification. Von Trier's film, I think, brings many aspects of these films to life in both accessible and very obvious ways, with its depiction, for instance, of two key female characters. Von Trier always has a central female protagonist, and in this film he splits them into Justine and Claire. And they each kind of swap around and take on the good and bad kind of object role. But it's Justine who is the central protagonist, who is consumed with melancholia. In addition to this, there is also a kind of splitting that goes on between their parents. Here, played by Charlotte Rampling, the mother Gabby, who is divorced from the absolutely despicable John Hurt as Dexter. And there is a troublesome kind of relationship with the manipulative Harvey Weinstein-esque figure of a boss, played by Stellan Skarsgård, who is called Jack. What von Trier seems to be doing then is trying to signal to us the profound inability of Justine, the main character played by Kirsten Dunst, to overcome her melancholic disposition despite numerous efforts throughout the film to do so. And I'm struck, for those of you who know the film, that the sequence around trying to eat meatloaf is unspeakable. I can't say any more than that. But I think we also need to note the way that von Trier also splits this singular female protagonist, so that there's a clear division, as I've already mentioned, between good and bad, even if the sisters do vacillate between those positions. And we need to contextualise this, I think, with reference to a story that von Trier tells about an encounter with his mother on her deathbed. And he tells this story in connection with his experience of making this film. So it's worth noting, I think, that von Trier makes Melancholia at a point where he himself has retired from the filmmaking scene due to a profound clinical depression and a profound inability to actually make work. And as part of his iteration of how this experience overcame him, he refers to this encounter with his mother on her deathbed when she took it upon herself to tell him that he was not the son of the father that he thought he was, and that Herr Trier was actually a benevolent spouse who had supported von Trier's mother to have an affair with a much more creative and cultured musician figure, actually, in order to have an artistic child. So she reveals this to him and thereby strips away his Jewish identity at the same time and then promptly dies. And so von Trier has repeatedly asserted that he regards melancholia as being intended in the spirit of saying, and I quote, a giant fuck you to his mother, years after these events took place. And this, I think, gives us an important insight into the persistence of traumatic feeling and fury. Plenty could be said about von Trier's film in relation to various aspects of melancholic experience, as symbolised in the relationship between Claire and John, played by... his name's gone from my head. He's the guy from 24. He's Jack Bauer. Kiefer Sutherland, thank you very much. So Claire and John, and their strange dance around suicide, and by the scenes that depict their struggle for who's going to get their hands on the pills that can kill them. And of course, in the end, it's John who kind of does the cowardly deed and sequesters the pills after hiding them from Claire and commits suicide in the stables. And I think this is the kind of theme that was touched on already by Jonathan when he was describing Benjamin's decision to kind of take the morphine overdose rather than face the possibility beyond the border. So these scenes depicting the inevitable interplanetary clash to come that are also dominant in the film also invite us to think in terms of projection and introjection. We see huge images of the planet Melancholia, beautifully lit and backlit, approaching. And Justine takes herself out in the midst of profound melancholy to bathe in the light of this threatening melancholic moon. I think this invites us very much to think about the mechanisms at work in terms of trying to recover and cope with a melancholic experience. So Justine here, reveling in her melancholy, literally by bathing in light of the planet, spells these mechanisms out. And I think these mechanisms are absolutely central for me in my reading of the Freud paper around mourning and melancholia too. Perhaps we can pick this up a little bit more when we come to discussion, thinking about the ways in which anxiety is manifest in this film. Because I think that the anxiety that's depicted in the film is not simply melancholic, but also has flavours around neurotic anxiety and other modes of identificatory anxiety that are not related to the melancholic disposition, although they do seem to inflect it. At the end of the film, it seems as though it's Justine, the melancholic, who has the least to lose, and so therefore the most to offer in terms of being able to tolerate the end of the world and to make it bearable for others. At the end of the film, she builds a magic cave for her nephew, Leo, and manages to forge a sense of relatedness in the face of imminent annihilation. Oh, so we're left wondering, is this a recovery of some sort on her behalf? And what does it mean to recover in order to die? However, I don't think it's enough for us just to think about the narrative of this film, because its form is also quite remarkable. As spectators, we do actually know the full story before we watch the film, because von Trier includes what he describes as an overture at the beginning. In other words, we know that everybody will die in the end. I just want to show you a brief few minutes from the overture sequence so that you can see something of the way in which von Trier manages to contrive this.
Thank you.
Okay, so I think in this so-called overture, what von Trier does is offer us a sequence that rephrases or rehearses the story that's yet to come. So we're forewarned, not so much forearmed, but forewarned as spectators about the depth of our melancholy that we are to expect, but also the way in which this eight-minute sequence conjures what it feels like to be in the grip of melancholia through its very metaphor-laden imagery, but also the incredibly slow motion, the incredible effects of the slow motion sequences manipulated through digital approaches to film, that conjures up something about the turgid kind of wading through mud, as we use that kind of idiom to express this dimension of experience. In writing on a Lacanian approach to the psychology of melancholia, critic Russell Grieg cites an observation made by Goethe. He says, "We die twice, first when we die, and then when those who we knew and loved die." This seems highly apposite when we think about how the narrative of this film unfolds. As spectators, of course, we don't literally die, but we do take up identificatory perspectives on scenes of total earthly annihilation. And so we might be said to die in some small way, at the level of fantasy at least. We're placed in an apparently impossible position by the film's ending, as we watch a film that entails the total destruction of all life, and yet paradoxically survive the annihilation involved and live to tell the tale, perhaps indeed to watch it over again, albeit the case that we might not feel able to speak its impact, as in my own experience. And this is surely a very melancholic paradox. The overture, I think, has an important function for the viewer of this film, acting in what Griselda Pollock has described in her work on Johannes Vermeer as an index of a lost moment before death, in which the anguish of loss is not in the image itself, but in the practice of its restaged or pre-staged encounter, where to look is to feel. And for me, this cinematic beginning plays an important part in shaping the spectator's relation to the film as an object, allowing us to envision our relationship to what we see on screen in ways that circumvent the kind of narcissistic over-identification with the image theorized in perspectives on spectatorship and desire in film studies by critics like Marianne Doane. Literary critic Serge Tisserand has suggested that fiction sets in play a continuous back-and-forth movement between the internalization of certain of the hero's traits and the projection of certain aspects of oneself onto the hero. So the cultural object invites relatedness, if you like, allowing the viewer actively and yet also unconsciously to engage with it. Now, as we know from Winnicott, our encounters with culture provide opportunities to revisit transitional phenomena. The first of which is the maternal breast, and I hope you noticed the image that Ivan cheekily grabbed from my presentation of the melancholia, the planet crashing into Earth and giving us a kind of extraordinarily unsubtle metaphor for the female breast. And Winnicott argues that the first transitional object is indeed the maternal breast, and this image, I think, reminds us of this. For Winnicott, of course, transitional phenomena allow us to experience anew the creative bridging between internal and external worlds, following on from the holding experience with the mother and our eventual separation from her. Yet it's important to distinguish the kind of engagement that we want to make with the object if we're to understand its psychological function. For Winnicott, there is an important distinction to be made between what he describes as object relating, in which the subject allows certain alterations in the self to take place so that the object has become meaningful, and the idea of object usage, where, because of the survival of the object, the subject may now have started to live a life in the world of objects, and so the subject stands to gain immeasurably. Because the object is capable of always being destroyed, it's felt by the subject to be more real. So the object in this formulation becomes something that we try to destroy in order better to be able to tolerate it, so as therefore to be able to use it constructively as a way of shoring up our fractured sense of identity. So I think the overture in Melancholia arguably allows us to perceive of the film as a reliable psychological object, one, if you like, that can survive our efforts to destroy it, and which therefore extends an invitation to the viewer to take it in for later psychological engagement. The film not only tells us that it will show us the end of the world before showing it to us, it also offers us the opportunity to experience a fantasy of annihilation as if it were our own, through its invitation to identify with the central characters and their experience. However, it also sets out to forewarn us that this will come at a cost, but that the cost will eventually become bearable if we're able to take in the object and to find a way of beginning to speak as its experience, as I think I'm struggling to do here today. A Winnicottian approach to this dynamic might allow me to sustain a hopeful and creative relationship to the experience of watching the film. I can use it to try to forge an understanding of Lars von Trier's well-documented experience of his own struggles with depression and mental ill health, and potentially therefore make creative use of this experience to articulate my own encounters with melancholic feelings. In my work on Lars von Trier, I've suggested that his cinema can be seen to have therapeutic potential of some kind, and that this can be understood in a number of ways. Firstly, I've tried to combine lenses of work by Winnicott on potential space, Melanie Klein on projective identification, and Wilfred Bion on containment to articulate this. Film becomes a means of working through the violent psychological experience of depression, using mechanisms of projection and projective identification, mechanisms that we use to make an unbearable experience visible to others. In this way, then, I think that the film comes to carry a kind of therapeutic potential for both director and spectator. However, Thomas Ogden might remind us that Bion offers an interesting take on this kind of experience, giving me a very different angle to think about, to think from. Ogden argues that Bion insists that projective identification is not only a fantasy, but a manipulation of one person by another, and therefore an interpersonal interaction. So perhaps then film can become a way of communicating experience, so that cinema becomes a kind of Bionian container. But this formulation requires us to think about how the contained can be conceptualized in, through, or with film and its consumption, and that's a challenge indeed. Since publishing my work on these themes, however, and since revisiting Melancholia in preparation for today's talk, I've begun to think about Bion's take on dreaming. For Bion, dreams are unconscious thoughts generated in response to lived emotional experience, and they provide us with an impetus for doing unconscious psychological work, according to Thomas Ogden. Ogden suggests that for Bion, the idea of the container contained addresses not what we think, but the way we think. That is, how we process lived experience and what occurs psychically when we're unable to do psychological work with that experience. It strikes me that there are parallels between Bion's ideas here and early work on cine psychoanalysis. This is the kind of film theory approach to the mechanisms and apparatus of cinema as a kind of dream screen that draws heavily on Freudian and Lacanian psychoanalysis to formulate an understanding of how cinema actually functions at the level of fantasy. Now, in film theory, the analogy between the dream and the cinema is commonplace, but it's usually figured through Freud or Lacan, as I've said. What would it mean for us to try to conceptualize notions of the gaze, cinematic identification, and so on, in terms of object relations, I wonder, and through Bion's work in particular? I think I'd like to argue that Bion's preoccupation with thinking gives us a new way to conceptualize the complexity of cinematic experience, such as viewing this film, for example. And it also highlights important dimensions of artistic practice and viewership. In the context of this film in particular, though, it goes further, allowing us to read through the palimpsest of imagery, music, narrative, character, and film form to articulate unspeakable aspects of human experience in ways that facilitate or allow the emergence of the representation of profound psychological distress. We're both invited into the film with its lure of identification and yet simultaneously reminded by all of these textual devices to hold our distance. The dream screen metaphor, then, is recast here so that it's not so much a discourse on fantasy and desire as one about the pursuit of experience in the name of psychological work. The ambivalence of this spectatorial position becomes complicated and difficult to keep in mind, as my own experience of this film has made me realise. Arguably, it positions us as melancholic through and through, leaving us with a profound sense of loss at the end of the film, and yet, at the same time, not knowing what it is that's been lost. So we're positioned as viewers with what Beyond famously evokes as binocular vision from the outset of the film, and I think that the overture works to alert us to this as well.
Caroline, 5 minutes.
Okay, that's fine. I think, as I've already highlighted in the discussion of the overture, that's okay. So it's as though in order to take up the invitation inherent in the projective identification offered by von Trier, the filmmaker, we have to struggle to become containers in order to make sense of the work. If you like, we have to internalise the experience underpinning the film as if it were our own, with all the implications that this demand carries in terms of taking in a loss that doesn't belong to us, but which, if I follow Klein, serves to remind us of all our own previous experiences of loss. So in taking up this invitation, what we appear to do is to take up a particularly melancholic gaze, one that might entail the self-denigration and self-silencing that's taken place in my own response to the film and my inability to speak of it until very recently. Or it might entail an ambivalent response in which von Trier is dismissed as a clown, playing with ideas of emotion and psychological experience, which was a response offered to me by a colleague when I first mentioned that I was trying to find a way to discuss my experience of this film. So in conclusion, then, what might all of this mean? Or is there any possibility of meaning in a melancholic experience? I think I'd like to leave the final words on this to von Trier himself by playing you an excerpt from a radio interview in which he articulates the importance of a psychoanalytic approach to thinking about melancholia and its relation to the field of human experience broadly. And I'll just have a few words to say afterwards, but I want to play you the clip first.
I know that you like metaphors more for themselves than for what they represent, for what you can excavate from them. Mm-hmm. But watching this film, I found it impossible not to think of the planet Melancholia as some kind of concrete version of depression, of a state of mind, possibly your own state of mind.
Yeah.
It's as banal as that, yes. I think melancholia is such an important ingredient in everything that's around us. And it is like, I know it's banal also, but it is like salt when you make food. You know, if there's no salt in the food, it just doesn't it brings out the taste. And melancholia is in everything, in music, in painting, and if it's not there, it's just not worth using time on. So of course, melancholia, and I think it is in many people, and it is this strange longing, and it is the wolf, you know, crying at the moon or whatever, and it is beauty, and it's scary, and it's cold, and it's warm, and melancholia, I think, is a very human thing, but when it goes further than just being melancholia and being goes to a depression or anxiety or whatever mental disease, then it's of course not good, but it's a very important part of being human.
As I watched the film, I felt I was being absorbed into a sort of depressive worldview, in a way, as though it was simulating the experience of depression. Okay. This was a situation in which not wanting to get out of bed, in which absolute pessimism was a totally rational response to what was going on.
Yeah, but it is a totally rational thing to do, and it's just that people haven't got it, all of them, yet, but they will. After a few more films of mine, they will not get out of bed.
So that's the master plan, is it?
It's to depress everybody
into this state that the light at the end of the cinematic experience will not relieve them from.
I wish there was a master plan, but there is not a master plan.
Do you think the melancholic are better equipped for catastrophe? Because Kirsten Dunst's character in this film flowers almost the more grave the more apocalyptic this scenario becomes.
I hope, because I have suffered so much from anxiety, that you have reached many times in your life 100% anxiety, right? So that when death comes knocking on your door, it's only the 100% again, and you've been there before. And that is actually what seems quite... I talk to, of course, a lot of doctors and stuff, and it seems that it's very likely that it will be a person with some mental illness that will be the hero that kind of drags children out of a burning train or stuff like that, because people that have never been there before, you know, never had an anxiety or never had kind of a, you know, never thought about this side of life will panic completely, whereas Justin has been there before and therefore can be much more rational.
Okay, so in finishing, I want to note the pertinence of the Albrecht Dürer image. Yeah. To the figuration of melancholia as feminine, and to the role of this image in shaping romanticism and its hijacking as part of the Nazi regime, and to wonder then at the associations we might make to Lars von Trier's infamous remarks about seeing himself as a Nazi at Cannes in 2011. And of course, these links to the feminine take us straight back to von Trier's mother's cruelty in the story I told you earlier, and to the craving for maternal containment that resounds throughout the narrative of melancholia, allowing us to read von Trier's provocations as elaborate defences of the kind invoked by Freud himself when he describes the loss of the love object as an excellent opportunity for ambivalence in love relationships. Importantly, however, for me, this link to the feminine offers me a new opportunity to rethink that old chestnut of film studies, the question of gender in the gaze. Conceiving of cinema as a potential scene of maternal containment, I think, might allow us to develop a deeper understanding of the emotional opportunities afforded by film and the sometimes puzzling, perverse pleasures we find in exploring unthinkable and unspeakable experience by means of this medium. Perhaps part of the problem with trying to think about the work of Lars von Trier is that it alerts us to our own internal iterations of his unpalatable character. So I'm left with the question of whether it's any wonder then that I've struggled to speak about this film, given its deeply troubling resonances. But perhaps this is why the invitation to do so was so compelling. So thank you for listening.
Well, thank you to Caroline for taking us into the film and into your own journey through trying to understand it. We are running slightly over time. We have we put in what's referred to as wriggle time. We had 10 minutes wriggle time. We now have 5 minutes wriggle time. But we could have some final thoughts. I don't know whether any of the...
Can I just ask Caroline a question?
Yeah, sure.
You just mentioned the word perversion at the end there, and I was thinking before that other speakers have talked about perversion. In terms of the names of the protagonists of Justine and Claire, I mean, is that a Desardian reference?
I think von Trier is obsessed with Desard and the story of Justine. He's absolutely obsessed with it. And
but,
the story but, you,
but is there yep. is there a more perverse element in this?
I think there's always a more perverse element when it comes to Lars von Trier.
Yeah. Right, but in that case, is Winnicott the right person to...
That's a very good question.
anyway, we'll discuss that another time.
I don't know whether any of the speakers want to have a final word. Jonathan? Or no? Ruth?
I haven't seen the film, so it's stupid to comment on it in a way, but I don't think that this is primarily about melancholia, even though that's what Trier says. I think it's about perversion, that if his mother has had a secret about who his father is, which she kept till a minute before her death, then poor little boy, grown-up man, has had his world shattered at the moment of his mother's death, that he's been living in a perverse scenario of his mother's mind.
That's a really important point, I think, and one thing that's noticeable about von Trier's publicity interviews around this film is that he describes this film as a cure, and he said that the work involved in dragging himself to the set and he describes an inability to hold the camera himself. in ways that are actually very evocative. And I think there was an important relationship between von Trier and Kirsten Dunst, who also spoke extensively in the publicity around the film about her own experiences of melancholia and depression. So there seems to be something that's being worked through, and what flavour or characteristic we name that as is a good question, I think.
We have just a little time. As with Ruth's paper, at the end of Ruth's paper, don't feel confined by the last paper you've heard. We haven't had much time to discuss things as we've gone along, so there may be other things that are coming up for you.
Yes, thank you for your beautiful paper. You mentioned several times melancholic thinking. Could you say a little bit more about that? What would be the pattern of melancholic thinking? Or is there a pattern? Or
just an easy one to close on, right? I think that's a really interesting question. For me, melancholic thinking has the kind of flavour of Justine entangled in her wedding dress in the ropes, and Claire carrying her child across the 19th hole of the golf course, sinking into mud. There's something that is impossible to speak and to articulate, but that can be recognised in the quality of melancholic thinking. I think that, you know, I can only talk from my own experience, so I'm not a clinician. But for me, in the grip of melancholic thinking, one can recognise that one is thinking without being able to speak. And it is something about this texture of psychological thinking experience that allows oneself to persist as a self. I can't really articulate this very well, but there's something about the experience of that melancholic state of mind and being able to recognise that as a rescue, a point of possible self-rescue or hope. The hope that's been mentioned a few times here as being projected into others may be persists in the imagery of melancholic thinking, but I'm not the person best positioned to comment on that.
Do you want to just say a couple of words to
what sort of words do you want me to say to close? Right, okay. Yeah, okay. I'll say a couple of words because I think one of the things that's kept on coming up, and it may relate to melancholic thinking, is about I think there are different ways of thinking about developmentally, about what stage somebody has to get to be able to deal with mourning. And I think they all have to do, and rather than sink into melancholia. And those ways of thinking have to do with being able to love and hate the same object. Now, for Klein, it's a depressive position. For Winnicott, well, he could never quite get away from depressive position, but it's really the stage of concern. Winnicott thought about depression as a developmental achievement in the sense that if one can love and hate the same object, then one can start to feel sadness about the damage done in fantasy to the object, and that's an achievement. Now, if those achievements aren't made, then I think the danger is more towards melancholia, where actually one gets the splitting of the object internally. So the work that can be done developmentally so that the splitting that's been going on, good object, bad object, can be brought together is a necessary forerunner, I think, for proper mourning. That's all I'd add, if that helps. I should hand over to, we've finished this part of our proceedings. And thank you, everybody. Thank you to all the speakers. I think it's been a very, very good day. And thank you to you for your attention and questions and discussion, both in the room and over coffee and lunch. And I should hand over to Anne, I think, should I? Yeah.
I don't think I...